Building a Winning Team. 4 August 2009. On 4 July, I was fortunate enough to represent our Air Force at NASCAR's Coke Zero 400. I joined over 100,000 Americans, undeterred by the summer heat, at the Daytona International Speedway. The energy at the Speedway was as thick as the humid air, and the excitement was contagious. Motorhomes covered the infield, and racing fans were everywhere. This was my first NASCAR event, and I knew it would be a treat. My first stop at the Speedway was the Air Force recruiting stand, set in the middle of energy drink booths and race team merchandise trucks. Our stand was clearly a hit as race fans swarmed over the different displays. I watched in awe as the members of the 333rd Recruiting Squadron managed the crowds with ease. The recruiters' enthusiastic smiles said it all. They were there to inspire. I was so proud to stand with them. The crowd asked questions. They thanked everyone in Air Force Blue for the service he or she provides every day. The recruiters reciprocated, engaging everyone with the Air Force story. They taught the public what the men and women of the Air Force do every day. You see, these recruiters were the first introduction many Americans would have to our Air Force. They weren't going to let any race fan leave with a bad impression. The recruiters were also at the race to find new recruits to fill our ranks. Accessing more than 32,000 new airmen each year doesn't happen by itself. It isn't a process to be taken lightly. These new airmen will be joining our team, enabling our mission for many years to come. We will depend on them to lead our Air Force through the next 35 years of challenges. The recruiters look for young, confident Americans ready for a challenge. I found out later they found more than 700 potential airmen that afternoon. I also learned that finding potential airmen is just half the battle. Only a handful of the 700 will eventually attend basic military training for various reasons. Before they get to BMT, it will be the recruiter's responsibility to invest significant time and effort educating them on opportunities within the Air Force and evaluating their potential to serve. It is the recruiter who will lead them through the upcoming months and set them up for success at both BMT and beyond. It is challenging work, but all of our recruiters volunteered for this duty and have a passion for telling America about our great Air Force. From the recruiting stand, I transitioned to the Speedway infield where NASCAR had set up a mobile stage on pit row. More than 100,000 race fans gathered to witness something special, a swearing-in ceremony for 65 new recruits. For the recruits, it was another step in their journey to BMT. They all raised their right hands and repeated as I recited the oath. The crowd roared in response as they finished, and each recruit's eyes beamed with pride. They knew they were joining a winning team. NASCAR immediately transitioned pit row for the race, and the crowds moved toward their seats. When the race began, the crowd's attention turned from the booths and information stands to the battle on the oval giant. The recruiters didn't pause to enjoy the race. Instead, they attacked the displays, tearing them down and loading trucks that would drive to the next race. While watching the event, I realized that the race teams competing on the Speedway share many similarities with our Air Force. Our nation loves auto racing, drawn by the rare mix of competition, danger, and teamwork. It is this teamwork that ties the Air Force to NASCAR. The drivers, much like the operators in our service, stand in front as they face the organization. Their success, however, is completely dependent on the hundreds of people that support them from the wings. Like our operators, the NASCAR drivers would never make it to the track if it were not for the combined efforts of crew chiefs, engineers, logisticians, administrators, and many others both at the track and team shops. However, one big difference between our Air Force and NASCAR drivers is how the teams are built. NASCAR builds a team that will compete for a season. It invests time, money, and manpower into training and race day execution, all with the ultimate goal of being the first to reach the checkered flag. There is nothing seasonal or static about our Air Force team. Without the ability of our recruiters to inspire the nation's finest to serve on a daily basis, our Air Force team would never be able to sustain its impressive record of excellence. The race ended after a final lap crash sprung the eventual winner through the checkered flag. The crowd rose to its feet as the winning driver spun his wheels in jubilation. His pit crew stood tall, arms high in the air, congratulating each other on the team's victory. The Air Force achieves victories each and every day, but rarely gets the chance to congratulate its recruiters. Take the time to thank them, for without these professionals and so many other support personnel like them, we would never even make it to the track. Technological change, 31 August 2009. I am a digital immigrant. You see, in the summer of 1972, as a senior at the Air Force Academy, I spent $125 on a small personal computer. At roughly $650 in today's dollars, the small unit was able to do four things: add, subtract, multiply, and divide. It was a cutting-edge calculator. Although we were permitted to use it only when checking our work, essentially it was my introduction to the world of computing. Today, we cannot accomplish our mission without technology and computing. Unlike me, those entering the Air Force today are digital natives. These natives don't remember a time when green military identification cards rarely left your wallet, the military personnel flight wasn't virtual, and blackberries were just a seasonal fruit. This got me wondering, has our leadership style adapted to take full advantage of the technology through the years? Has technology improved a leader's ability to make a difference? Let's start by looking at how technology has changed the workplace. Beyond the most noticeable and tangible aspects, like email, PowerPoint, and cell phones, I contend that technology has transformed the workplace in three main areas: collaboration, automation, and personal accessibility. Collaboration includes our ability to network, collect, and share information. Getting the right information to the right people when they need it isn't always as easy as it sounds. After all, accurate information is a key element in making objective decisions, and objectivity is what keeps our organizations headed in the best direction. Today's challenge, however, is managing the sheer volume of available information. Technological advancements will only make this challenge greater in years to come. By automation, I'm talking about technology's impact on the tasks we do every day. Historically, automation has been one of the enablers for doing more with less. Our most expensive asset is our people. Technology gives us the ability to energize certain efficiencies by replacing manpower. Maintaining the balance of technology and manpower will continue to be a daily leadership challenge. Accessibility applies to our ability to contact anyone, anywhere, anytime through voice and data communication. There are two key aspects of accessibility: how leaders make themselves available to others and how you, as a leader, take advantage of the availability of others. It is important that commanders, while making themselves available at all hours of the day, don't foster an environment where subordinates are afraid to get decisions from anywhere but the top. At the same time, leaders must guard against exploiting the availability of others, especially subordinates. Such exploitations will reinforce to subordinates that decisions can come from the top only. Accessibility has also changed how we make ourselves available to others. Many commanders like to say that they have an open-door policy. Don't fool yourself into thinking that issues will always walk through the open door. Leaders still need to escape the electronic accessibility, namely email, and seek human interaction. A new airman in the squadron isn't going to raise a concern by walking into a commander's office, but the airman might if the commander is able to interact in his or her own work environment. Leadership by walking around will always be a positive leadership principle. I like to think that there are three kinds of people when dealing with technology: pessimists, optimists, and realists. The technology pessimists are those people who resist any change due to improved technologies. Technology optimists jump at the earliest opportunity to implement any technological advancement. The last category, the technology realist, makes up the lion's share of us all. The realist accepts that change is necessary and works to integrate improvements, but doesn't continually search for and implement emerging technology. Our organizations need all three technology types to run smoothly. It is necessary for each of us to understand what kind of technologist we and those whom we work around are. This is simply another medium where one size won't fit all. Leaders must adapt their style depending on whom they deal with and the nature of the task to be performed. The pessimist may not hear the things communicated electronically. By the same token, resist the temptation to send all correspondence electronically to the optimist, even though his or her response might be within seconds. Always push for the personal touch and realize that your approach will be different for each person. In essence, leadership is the challenge of inspiring the people in an organization on a goal-oriented journey. Technology enables that journey, and we as leaders must successfully manage both the benefits and detriments of that evolution. Ultimately, leaders are still responsible for themselves, their people, and the results of their units. It's how they can make a difference in both the lives of their people and in the unit's mission. It is the one thing technology will never change. A Tale of Two Instructors, 21 September 2009. Students and instructors primarily make up AETC. On the surface, the instructors simply teach certain skills so that students are ready for new challenges. In reality, they contribute so much more. Instructors make us better airmen and continually raise our level of performance by enforcing the standards. They make a difference by tailoring their message and connecting with every student. I cannot tell you the number of times senior officers and NCOs have shared stories about an instructor who made a difference in their lives. I know you can think of instructors that had a positive impact in your life. I am no different. Let me tell you about two instructors that helped shape who I am today. The first instructor who made a difference in my life was Captain Leonard J. Chicken Funderburk. He flew OV-10s in Vietnam and was awarded the Air Force Cross for heroism. He flew hard, played hard, and at 6'5" with a black belt in karate, was larger than life. Numerous stories about his heroic feats in Vietnam and phenomenal instruction in the T-37 Tweet were passed down from class to class. Even before my class left academics to start flying the T-37, we were awed by Chicken's reputation. After graduation, I was assigned to D Flight in the 43rd Flying Training Squadron at Craig Air Force Base, Alabama. Along with two other classmates, I sat at a table next to Chicken's. Every day, I had a front row seat to Chicken's post-flight debriefings. It was a sight to behold. Chicken dissected every element of the training sortie and demanded that his students were well prepared and flew their best. His students, with nervous smiles trying to feign confidence, always started the debrief sitting straight up in their chairs. This posture never lasted long, for after 2 hours of continuous critique, smiles quickly vanished and bodies eventually melted toward the floor. I was so thankful Chicken was not my instructor. I flew training sorties with my assigned instructor and had some good days. Other days I'd rather forget. Unfortunately, one of those not-so-good days was my pre-solo sortie. I busted the ride and wasn't cleared to solo like my other classmates. I was absolutely crushed. My flight commander decided I needed a change and called me into his office. He told me he was shifting me to a new instructor. I'm sure he watched the color leave my face when he told me my new instructor would be Chicken. I begged him not to do it, especially after just having busted a ride. I started to doubt that I would make it through the program. The next day, I sat across from Chicken, mortified. I knew he could see right through my feigned smile. I tried to focus on my sortie as his deep voice stepped through the elements of the upcoming pre-solo mission. He told me one thing over and over again. Always be hot and be high. Never be low and be slow. He must have said it 10 times. He took me out to the flight line and told me to climb into the T-37. Since I had busted the previous pre-solo ride, I knew this sortie really counted. We took off, and he set me up first for a straight-in approach, followed by a single engine and then a no-flap landing. As I look back, each one of these approaches was average to slightly below average. After the last planned approach, Chicken turned to me and yelled, "Lorenz, you are going to kill me. Put her on the deck." With those words, I knew I was finished and probably going to wash out of pilot training. I landed, and he then told me to shut down the number 2 engine. All of a sudden, I realized he was going to let me solo. I was elated. As Chicken stepped from the aircraft, he once again said, "Always be hot and be high. Never be low and be slow." I took off and had a very uneventful solo sortie. Chicken realized that I lacked a little confidence and just needed the right kind of instruction and motivation to succeed. Over the next few months, Chicken's demanding teaching style gave me the confidence not only to complete pilot training, but also to face subsequent challenges in both my professional and private lives. I have never forgotten him or how he made a difference in my life. I encountered the second instructor who made a difference in my life much later in my career. In 1986, I was stationed at Castle Air Force Base, California, and was selected to upgrade to instructor pilot in the KC-135. In order to upgrade, everyone had to complete a 6-week program called Central Flight Instructor Course. It was a very demanding course that trained upgrading instructors how to teach aircraft systems and flight procedures. It emphasized the many ways students could unintentionally back into harrowing situations and helped instructors to correct the errors before everyone on board became another safety statistic. I didn't bat an eye when Captain Rusty Findlay, now Lieutenant General Rusty Findlay, Air Mobility Command Vice Commander, and I were teamed with the most famous KC-135 Central Flight Instructor Course trainer in the fleet at that time, Lieutenant Colonel Earl Orban. Colonel Orban was famous for being straightforward, thorough, relentless, and demanding. We had both heard horror stories about how his level of instruction was challenging. Rusty and I had been flying the KC-135 for years. We were long in experience and confidence and looked forward to the course. After all, we knew the KC-135 and its systems inside and out. For us, the instructor course was going to be a breeze. Through a series of Colonel Orban's challenging training sorties, including grueling pre-briefs and debriefs, one thing became clear. I was too overconfident in my existing abilities and systems knowledge. My overconfidence had led me to become complacent. During flight operations, much like other career fields, complacency can kill. It can lead one to overestimate his or her own abilities while not paying enough attention to the student's lack of ability. I quickly changed my approach, increased my level of preparation, and arrived each day on top of my game. I left the course with the instructional skills I would need during each upcoming mission. Colonel Orban was fair, firm, and demanding. He pushed Rusty and me, forced both of us to grow as aviators and instructors. He reminded us that flying is an unforgiving business where everyone's limits vary from day to day, sortie to sortie. We needed to balance our own limits with those of the student. Since then, I have learned to apply this lesson in other areas of my life as well. I think it has made me a better aviator, officer, husband, father, and friend. Instructors like Captain Funderburk and Colonel Orban make a difference every day and are the backbone of our Air Force's excellence. Although my instructors employed different techniques, they looked at me through a clear lens, saw where I needed improvement, and tailored their instructions specifically for me. When you have that opportunity, follow the lead of Chicken, Colonel Orban, and all the instructors that have made a difference in your life. Take the time to make a positive impact in each of your students' lives, regardless of whether those students are found at work or in the community. It is what I strive to do each day, and it's the only way that our Air Force will remain the best in the world. Cherish your spouse. 20 October 2009. Just last week, while walking past the base chapel, I witnessed a scene that caused me to pause and reflect. I turned and watched as people, dressed in their Sunday best, flowed from the chapel door, smiling and casually chatting. They slowly split into two lines, creating a path that led to a waiting limousine. The crowd stood and waited, fueling my anticipation. Suddenly, a photographer burst from the doors, then turned and captured a bride and groom as they ran outside. The crowd erupted with cheers. The bride, white gown flowing as she ran, paused to hug a friend. The groom immediately tugged at her hand, pulling her toward the waiting limousine. Without pause, they hopped in the limousine, and the crowd again cheered as they sped away. I couldn't help but smile as I watched the newly married military couple start their new life together. It made me think about our spouses and our military families. The Secretary of the Air Force and our Chief of Staff named 2009 as the Year of the Air Force Family. In doing so, they hope to bring more attention to the sacrifices our families endure and the service they provide our nation. I couldn't agree with them more. Our families, especially our spouses, are the foundation that enables each of us to serve in the world's greatest Air Force. I don't think anyone would argue the importance of having such a foundation. Our lives need balance, and our spouses help provide that stability. I like to use the analogy that such balance is similar to the spokes of a bicycle wheel. You see, a bicycle needs balanced spokes to provide a smooth ride. Our lives are no different. I think of the spokes as the different priorities in our lives. If one of the spokes, such as the relationship with your spouse, the needs of your children, or the responsibilities at work, gets slighted, the wheel no longer rolls the way it should. It might even get to the point where it stops rolling altogether. We must balance each of our life spokes very deliberately and carefully. When we are balancing shortfalls and managing a limited amount of time, money, and manpower, our spouses often are the ones who get shortchanged. We can't afford to let that happen and must always make time to tell our spouses how much we appreciate them. When you're tired from the challenges at work, take a deep breath, walk in the door with a smile, and tap your energy reserve to make a difference with the time that you have. It only takes a minute to let them know how much you care. A simple squeeze of the hand, rub on the shoulder, or a phone call during the day. Think about the things that make you feel appreciated and loved. Do those things for them in return, and always strive to give more than you receive. Maintaining the friendship, trust, and energy in a relationship isn't an easy thing to do. It's a full-time job. It's up to you to make it a fun job for both you and your spouse. In a recent article, I talked about the danger of complacency in our professional lives. The same goes for our personal lives, too. Many people confuse complacency with comfort. Although comfort can help build stability in a relationship, complacency can cause a relationship to drift apart. Never, ever take your spouse for granted. Our spouses make significant sacrifices daily. There are countless stories of spouses who go above and beyond, stories of men and women who volunteer in the local community and pursue their own successful careers despite long days and the deployments of their military spouses. There are even more untold stories about spouses who quietly make a difference every day. The story of the wife who, after a long swing shift, returns home to wake her family, cooks everyone breakfast, and sends them all out the door before collapsing herself. The story of the husband who stays up all night taking care of sick children so that his wife can go to work rested and ready. Resist the temptation to become accustomed to such acts of sacrifice and kindness. These tremendous examples are often interrupted by the other stories. We've all done boneheaded things, forgotten important occasions, not paid enough attention to our spouse's concerns, or tried to solve their challenges for them instead of just listening sympathetically. Work hard to avoid these thoughtless acts in the first place. Be critical of yourself and the things you do. Your standards of excellence at work should be no different when at home. When you feel your spouse has neglected you in some manner, it is best to forgive without pretense. put past grudges aside so that you can move forward together. After all, forgiveness is what you hope for after apologizing for those boneheaded things I just discussed. As I turned to leave, the crowd had already forgiven the bride and groom's hasty departure and started to dissipate from the front steps of the chapel. The couple was starting their life together as a military team. I thought of my spouse, Leslie. We made a commitment to each other more than 34 years ago. We knew that our lives would be better if spent together and have learned through the years to depend on each other in order to accomplish our goals. For me, Leslie has been the key to keeping my wheel balanced. I've worked hard through the years to make each day with her better than the one before, to keep my wheel rolling smoothly. Our individual strength comes from the foundation that our spouses provide at home. By cherishing our spouses and making sure they know how much we appreciate them, our wheel can continue to cruise happily through life as well. Spotting disasters. 23 November 2009. I can hear that train coming down the tracks. If you're like me, you've heard people use this analogy to describe an inbound issue or challenge. We all face daily challenges. They're nothing new. The challenges range in significance and in their ability to impact our organizations. Although the potential challenges do have unique characteristics, all have one thing in common. The sooner leaders can spot them, the more they can do to manage how the challenge will influence their organization. In reality, it's pretty easy to know when a train is coming down the tracks. It is big, makes a lot of noise, and is accompanied by warning lights and bells. Trains typically run on a schedule, making it even easier to know when to either step to the side or hop on board. We rarely get the same notification from an impending crisis in the workplace. More often, it appears seemingly out of thin air and immediately consumes more time than we have to give. Through frustrated, tired eyes, we wonder where the crisis came from in the first place. Even though we vow never to let it happen again, deep down, we know that it is only a matter of time before the next one hits our organization by surprise. Such an outlook is what helped create an entire school of thought called crisis management. We have crisis action teams, emergency response checklists, and other plans that describe how to effectively deal with the train that we never saw coming. These impacts can be hard to absorb and typically leave casualties behind. Would it be better to prepare for specific contingencies and not rely on generic crisis response checklists? Wouldn't it be better for the organization if a leader knew about the train long before it arrived? So how does a leader get the schedule for inbound trains? In many cases, just getting out of the office and talking to the organization's members can help a leader identify potential issues and areas of risk. By the same token, if you are a member of an organization and know of an upcoming challenge, it is your responsibility to research and report it. Candor within an organization is critical to success. Information must flow in all directions to maintain efficiency and effectiveness. In addition to cultivating a culture of candor within an organization, a successful leader must be able to maintain objectivity to spot inbound trains. After all, allowing emotion to creep into a leader's perspective may provide short-term success, but will eventually create mid- and long-term unintended challenges. Rising above the issues at hand makes it far easier to hear the potential challenges and competing interests before they arrive. Candor and objectivity alone will probably help catch 90% of the issues before they impact an organization. In order to achieve 100%, a leader must work hard to avoid complacency. When things get quiet within an organization, it doesn't necessarily mean that everything is being handled successfully. In fact, the hair on the back of every leader's neck should start to stand up when things get quiet. After all, it probably means the leader isn't involved enough in the daily operation of the unit, and that the first two elements, candor and objectivity, are being overlooked. This is the time to be even more aggressive about candor, information flow, and objectivity. Leaders who work hard to enable candor, remain objective, and discourage complacency get a unique opportunity to steer their organizations in the best direction when challenges or crises loom. As they identify the inbound trains, leaders can decide whether to maneuver clear or to hop on board. You see, each inbound train is an opportunity. It is a chance to fight for new resources, money and/or manpower, and to unify their team toward a common objective. Leaders should anticipate inbound trains as a means to improve their organizations. Crisis action teams and emergency response checklists certainly aren't bad things. After all, no matter how hard you try, there will always be something that catches your organization by surprise. When you see a train coming down the tracks, don't just stand in front and brace for the impact. Be ready to take full advantage of the opportunities it creates. Not only will you be more efficient and effective, you will ensure that your organization will continue in the best direction to achieve short, mid, and long-term objectives. Jessica's Legacy, 15 December 2009. There are certain times in our lives when a single moment or significant event causes us to pause and reflect. These moments can catch us after both happy times and sad, after accomplishments of our own or those of others. Sometimes they catch us off guard, by surprise. More often, though, these moments sit out in front of us and we either run into their embrace or we are drawn toward them despite struggles to avoid them. This holiday season, I found myself at one of those moments. I was hosting a tour through the Center for the Intrepid, CFI, at Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio, Texas. The CFI is an amazing facility that helps rehabilitate military members who have suffered significant injury. I love walking through the CFI. It is a bright, airy building filled with hope. On the top floor of the circular building, there is a window-lined hallway with pictures of those injured soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines whose lives were touched by the CFI team. It was there, looking at the large photos, that a particular pose caught my eye. The photo took me back to last June to a memorial service for one of our airmen who, at 24 years of age, left our ranks far too soon. Senior Airman Jessica Tarver stared from the photo, a smile beaming from ear to ear. Her story is one of perseverance and strength. A rare infection that she contracted during her second tour in Iraq tragically led to 2 years of challenges that, along the way, took both of her legs and, eventually, her life. Jessica's memorial ceremony at the CFI had seating for 75, but twice as many stood around the perimeter to attend. Such a crowd is one of the simplest and strongest compliments anyone can receive. She was an inspirational person, and I, along with so many others, am better for having known her. During the ceremony, many people stood to talk and reflect on their special relationship with Jessica. Her squadron commander, Lieutenant Colonel Raymond James, had flown to San Antonio from Hurlburt Field, Florida. Jessica's battle began right after he took command of the 1st Special Operations Helicopter Maintenance Squadron. In fact, he'd been on the job for only 2 weeks when Jessica first went into the hospital. His words resonated. Someone who had been forced to deal with a challenging situation from the very first days of command. Through Jessica, Colonel James grew into the seasoned, well-respected leader that he is today. All of the members of the squadron and the Air Force at large benefited from Jessica's courage, inner strength, and perseverance. One of her doctors stood to reflect on her memories of Jessica. While most double amputees work hard to walk in athletic shoes, Jessica told the doctors and physical therapists that she wanted to walk in 6-inch heels. A tear fell from the doctor's eye while remembering the moment when Jessica strutted down the hall on 4-inch stiletto heels with her prosthesis. She had been an inspiration. The others who flowed past the podium to tell their story and reflect on their relationship with Jessica shared a similar theme. Although their interactions varied, in each case they described a woman who challenged them to be better than before. She made a difference in their lives, and they were there to say thank you. Through her example, Jessica left them wiser, stronger, and more able to handle future challenges. She was their wingman. The caregivers from the CFI stood around the ceremony, embracing the sadness. These are the selfless heroes who meet the unknown each day with a steadfast confidence and compassion. Their approach instills hope and enables otherwise impossible opportunities for their patients. They, too, make a difference in people's lives. I could still feel the warmth of that embrace standing in the circular hallway last month, gazing at Jessica's portrait. She'd taught everyone so much, challenged all to grow, and strengthened our Air Force family. It is now our duty to play this forward and push everyone to be better airmen, teammates, and wingmen. Such a message must never die. Standing in the hallway, I found myself feeling so thankful for having known Jessica Tarver and the way her smile could brighten any room. I also felt thankful for the members of the CFI team and all the good that they do. Lastly, I was then and am forever thankful for each of you, the service you provide our nation, and the difference you make every day. May we never forget the positive example and spirit of those Jessicas in our lives. A Mentor's Influence. 2 February 2010. Mentors touch our lives and help shape us into the people that we are today. We value mentorship in the Air Force and develop it in our subordinates while seeking it from our supervisors. One cannot have enough mentors, nor can one mentor enough. I've had many through the years, but one sticks out above the rest. This particular mentor touched my life in two important ways, separated by nearly 40 years. While a cadet at the Air Force Academy, I struggled to keep my grades up. I was on the dean's other list 6 of 8 semesters. In the end, I managed to defeat my academic demons and graduate with a commission in 1973. But I certainly didn't do it alone. I owe my success, in a large part, to my academic advisor and mentor, Colonel Joe Hingem. Colonel Hingem wasn't what I expected when I met him for the first time in 1971. To be honest, I don't think I knew what to expect. He had been awarded the Silver Star for heroism while flying helicopters in Vietnam. I quickly learned that Colonel Hingem was the kind of person who was easy to look up to and even easier to follow. When he took me and my academic worries under his wing, I was proud to be there. I knew that his guidance, combined with persistence and determination on my part, would lead me through the challenge. In the end, it most certainly did. When I walked across the stage with the rest of the class of 1973, I strode with the confidence that Colonel Hingem had helped build within me. He had been a crucial part of my academy experience and, in many ways, part of who I am today. I kept in touch with Colonel Hingem over the years, often thanking him for making a difference in my life. I never imagined that Colonel Hingem would impact me all over again, especially at this point in my career. The second time Colonel Hingem touched my life began with tragic news. On 1 January of this year, Colonel Hingem passed away after a long illness. His son Mark asked if I would speak at his father's memorial service. I was touched by his request and spent hours trying to find the right words to convey how great a person had just left our earth. I wanted to make sure that everyone understood the lasting difference he made in the lives of others. When it was my turn to speak, it came from my heart. I told the crowd about a man who dedicated his life to serving and helping others. When I finished, Mark rose to speak. While listening to Mark's story, I found Colonel Hingem leading me on another journey. I was touched and wanted to share the story with you. A few months ago, Mark accompanied his father to the hospital, and they both knew what was about to happen. The doctor was going to tell Colonel Hingem that he only had 3 months left to live. It was an appointment they both were dreading. While riding up to the doctor's floor, Colonel Hingham greeted the janitor sharing the elevator with them. He complimented the janitor for keeping the building so clean. The janitor was shocked. No one ever thanked him before. Colonel Hingham noticed the building and took the time to notice the janitor. It resonated with me. That janitor would never forget Colonel Hingham. When getting off the elevator, Colonel Hingham introduced Mark to the receptionist. He told Mark about the receptionist's son, who is a Marine and currently flying combat missions in Afghanistan. He reassured the receptionist that her son would come home safely. Marines are excellent pilots. Not only had Colonel Hingham met and talked with the receptionist before, but he also remembered her and took precious time to introduce his son. He even thought to reassure her fears with a son deployed to combat operations. Now think about it. Colonel Hingham was riding the elevator to find out that he didn't have much time left. Instead of lamenting his fate, he was concerned about others. That day, he made a difference in their lives. Almost 37 years after I had graduated from the Air Force Academy, Colonel Hingham was once again making a difference in my life. I always like to tell people that they should strive for two things in life: making a difference in people's lives and leaving the campground better than they found it. Colonel Hingham certainly did that throughout his 75 years. He mentored me as a cadet at the Air Force Academy, and once again just this last month. I couldn't ask for a better mentor and friend. Go ahead and thank those who've guided you through the years and take time to make a difference in the lives of those you mentor. Our Air Force is only as good as those who serve. Let's all work hard to make each of us a little better every day, just as Colonel Hingham did for me and many others. A dynamic tradition. 23 February 2010. Our Air Force has many traditions. Some we inherited from other services, others are more recent and will take time to fully develop. Traditions are positive things deeply rooted in our heritage and pride. Traditions are things we don't easily give up. One of our traditions, however, isn't often recognized as positive and doesn't get the applause it deserves. That tradition is one of our strongest and most resilient. You see, our Air Force is dynamic, always adapting to meet new missions and to counter new threats. With our world and its realities continually evolving around us, living in a culture of change is inevitable. This creates a level of uncertainty, and people generally don't like uncertainty. Such change, however, is vitally important and allows us to maintain our efficiency, effectiveness, and relevance. So then, what is the best way for a leader to guide people through change? There are certainly many methods to do so, and each one depends on the type of change expected. In all cases, however, the principles that underlie the preparation for change are the same. Preparation builds confidence, helps a leader's organization be less fearful of approaching uncertainty, and ensures the organization is much more effective once change arrives. This is where education and training come into play. We educate in order to prepare for uncertainty. Education helps us understand why the change is necessary. It also helps us objectively assess the environment and rationale necessitating the change. With objectivity, we can unemotionally assess the benefits and drawbacks of the different potential courses of action. Education is a never-ending self-improvement process. The different levels are predicted to occur at specific spots in our careers, opening doors and creating opportunities. Because the Air Force lines up education programs with future levels of responsibility, it can be difficult to adequately catch up on education. Never pass up the opportunity to further your education. While education helps us prepare for uncertainty, training programs are designed to prepare for certainty. After all, it's those things that we expect that fill our syllabi and lesson books. We train for them over and over until recognizing and reacting to them are second nature. This is one reason why we use checklists so often in the Air Force. They help lead us accurately through challenging times. Through experience, our collective list of certainty grows. It shapes the evolution of our training programs. You see, when we react to challenge, we create a certain result. Positive results reinforce the action and make us more confident. Although the positive result trains us to use the same response next time, it typically doesn't teach us to handle anything but the exact same challenge. When we make mistakes or experience negative results, we truly have an opportunity to learn. Even though it may not be as much fun to investigate our failures, we are more apt to critically assess the challenge and develop other, more successful potential courses of action. This is why our integrated safety programs, after-action teams, and lessons learned archives are so valuable. They are an effort to take advantage of the experiences and mistakes of others and avoid having to learn the same lessons over and over again. In essence, such programs help us prepare for future uncertainty and help bridge our learning programs from the training arena into our education enterprise. As a leader, you must ensure that your people have the education necessary to prepare for uncertainty and the training to guide them through certainty. As an individual, you must aggressively pursue these opportunities to further develop yourself as well. Such preparation will instill the confidence necessary to embrace change. Implementing new ideas in your organization can be challenging. It takes careful thought, skilled execution, and the full support of your team. It can also take time. It is always important to be evolutionary with change and not revolutionary. That way, your changes will have a much better chance to succeed over time. Sometimes it is hard to take pride in a culture of continuous change, but within uncertainty is opportunity, and opportunity helps fuel growth. Today, we must all adapt to change more rapidly than ever before. It is one of our oldest and most important traditions, and one that I hope will never change. The Solid Foundation, 27 February 2010. Our Air Force has more than 175,000 civilian employees spread across the globe. In fact, they make up more than 25% of our authorized total force in strength. The civilian force fills an ever-increasing role in daily mission accomplishment, especially as we've experienced personnel reductions over the past 20 years and, many would argue, no decrease in operational requirements. In reality, we are busier than ever, and our civilian workforce makes it all possible. Each of you knows many civilian employees. They are the glue that holds our Air Force together and the stability that our organizations rely on. Through the years, I've been fortunate enough to depend on the counsel and wisdom of hundreds of civilians. Time won't permit me to reflect upon all of them, but let me highlight three senior service civilians that made a positive influence in my life. The first one I'll tell you about is Art Saris. I first met Mr. Saris when I was a captain at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Ohio. A veteran of the Army Air Corps during World War II, Mr. Saris began his civil service career in 1946 and worked his way through the logistics ranks until he became the senior civilian employee in the Air Force Logistics Command in 1974. Despite his significant responsibilities, Mr. Saris took time to mentor me. He explained current issues and challenges and helped me see them through his eyes. Not only did I have an immediate respect for his tenured wisdom, but understanding his senior perspective early in my career proved invaluable throughout time. Mr. Saris also helped me gain a newfound appreciation for the thousands of civilians working at the air logistics centers across the country. After all, their efforts directly enabled the daily combat capability of our force then, just as they continue to do today. I met many more amazing civilians during the next 30 years, but the next I'd like to discuss is Roger Blanchard. When I met him, he was the Assistant Deputy Chief of Staff for Personnel at the Pentagon. Mr. Blanchard started his civil service career in 1973 as an intern at Kelly Air Force Base, Texas, and diligently worked his way through the personnel ranks. When our paths crossed, I was the director of the Air Force budget and marveled at how many sought his counsel, including service secretaries and chiefs of staff. You see, Mr. Blanchett had no personal agenda, and his advice always reflected deep thought. He worked problems, not personalities. Not surprisingly, Mr. Blanchett was a quiet person. As a result, whenever he spoke, people turned their heads to listen. They knew they were about to hear something thoughtful, relevant, and valuable. Through him, my respect for those personnelists throughout our Air Force increased every day. After all, it's their expertise in an often thankless field that supports our greatest resource, all of us. The last civilian I'll highlight is Bob Stewart. Bob was my deputy director of the Air Force budget during my most recent time at the Pentagon. When I got to the job, I was in need of some help. My Air Force experience up to that point focused mainly on aircraft operations, not the budget process. I was the fourth director he had worked for as a deputy. He had worked in finance in the Pentagon for more than 30 years, providing the stability the organization relied on every day. Bob was always thinking ahead. In fact, it was his vast knowledge that helped guide the budget office. I've often thought that Bob's influence far exceeded what would have been had he been the boss. In the end, Bob did as the others had done. He left me with a great respect for all those financial managers and an appreciation for their daily impact on the Air Force mission. These three civilians are examples of the thousands who make up our Air Force team today. They are invaluable experts whose hard work and good, honest feedback help us to learn and improve. Although the advice may not be always something we want to hear, such counsel is what everyone should expect. After all, in most cases, our civilian force has probably seen the pitfalls and potential second and third order consequences of our well-intentioned decisions before. Such vision only helps all of us make better informed decisions for our organizations. We can't be the finest Air Force in the world without our civil servants. They are the foundation we rely on each day to do our jobs. Take time to appreciate their impact and thank them for making such a positive difference for our Air Force team. Motivation, 14 April 2010. These are challenging times for our Air Force. We have been engaged in combat operations since 1990 and are balancing limited resources against an aggressive operations tempo. We are once again adjusting to maintain our authorized end strength while juggling priorities within a leveling budget. Many of our aircraft are beyond expected service lives, and current operations are aging them even faster. Handling all these demands will be challenging. It will not be fun. This is where leadership comes into play. Whether at work or at home, everyone has issues. As some issues are resolved, others are always waiting in line to take their places. The pay me now or pay me later mindset is exhausting. It is up to each organization's leadership to set the tone, motivate the workplace, and create a sustainable culture of success. After all, we want our airmen to invest themselves in our service and our mission. So, how can a leader attack such challenges and create sustainable excellence? We all know that it isn't easy to do. It will take dedication, objectivity, and a lot of patience and perseverance. Along the way, tough decisions will be required, and each will call for a tailored approach. In other words, leaders must adapt differently to each situation. Situational leadership is how we keep our organizations motivated and headed in the best direction. We all have unique leadership styles. Some of us probably smile a little too much, while others don't smile quite enough. We all fit somewhere along a leadership continuum where the ends are defined by the extremes. Although you may feel most comfortable in one region of that continuum, realize that every leader will have to utilize approaches from the full range of the continuum in response to different challenges. A career brings many leadership challenges, and leaders must adapt to meet each one. After all, some challenges will require leaders to soften their approaches. For example, someone in the organization may be directly affected by our in-strength reductions. Maybe the unit will suffer the loss of one of its members. Other situations will require a stern approach. This may be necessary when accountability and disciplinary challenges confront the organization or some of its personnel. Effective leaders must be able to approach difficult decisions or situations with the entire continuum at their disposal. In the end, leaders must approach a challenge with an eye toward crafting a solution to meet organizational needs. They should consciously select a leadership style or customized approach to create a certain effect. For most situations, mission accomplishment will be the effect, the end goal. However, before one can achieve such an effect, situational leadership must be used to motivate others toward success. After all, a motivated force can move mountains. Motivation is an interesting concept. In some situations, motivation is more spontaneous and flows from the heart. In others, motivation is far from intrinsic and needs a little added emphasis from the top. I call it added emphasis because sometimes your organization won't be too thrilled with the changes after they're announced. It may feel like you're marching your team uphill and into the wind. Leaders must look at each challenge, develop a plan, and push for success. As part of their plan, they must develop the motivation necessary to assist their organizations through the challenges. In the end, people don't quit their jobs, despite all the challenges we face every day. They quit their bosses. The art of motivating organizations through challenges is one of the keys to any leader's success. Today, more than ever before, we need intellectual leaders who value the power of thought and innovative approaches. After all, having leaders who think, assess challenges objectively, and motivate their teams to succeed is what makes us the formidable fighting force we are today.